Perception.
Come from you last year, everyone did really well.
Right. So this is finance law, and this is us doing our first session on financial derivatives. Now, as we have mentioned, financial derivatives are examinable as a thing in themselves. We're thinking about them not in terms of problem answering or anything of that sort. You're not going to have a seminar specifically on this, okay, because we just couldn't fit it in the course. But in good conscience, I didn't think you could go away having looked at finance or without finding out a bit about derivatives. So if the sirens ever stop, I will yell and screech over them and try and explain what financial derivatives are and how some of the legal issues work. Are they coming for you? This was scary. Good luck, and we didn't see you. I did try and get this room for kind of next Thursday. I don't know if you want to go to the George Hine. If people need to go, then go, obviously. I haven't been able to get the room, apparently. I don't know if it's if the college is shut or whatever. We haven't been able to book it for next week, and we don't know that someone else hasn't got it. So, you know, catering for do or something like that. So, unfortunately, we've got our double session tonight, in case anyone's wondering what's going on. Because we miss Friday, because it's Good Friday. I mentioned that before. Anyway, so what we're trying to do is think about financial derivatives. Today, let's try and think about what are financial derivatives. We've described them very briefly in the past, so we'll try and unpack them a bit again today. I don't think it's incredibly essential to be able to talk about the law on financial derivatives that you understand the ins and outs of the product, but I know it makes life much easier if you know vaguely what's going on. Because what we're then going to focus on, 113 and 114 tells us about some of the risks involved and what a derivative is, and then we start with options. Are we not paying you enough attention? Please don't throw your water at the nice man in front. We're going to talk about forwards, we're going to talk about interest rate swaps, which are the three core types of financial derivative. We'll repeat that again in a second. So you've got descriptions of what they are. Now, page 116 and onwards, you've then got credit derivatives, which will bring us back to the financial crisis. By the time we've got through to them, that might have been enough for today. If you remember page 117, many, many months ago, we talked about master agreements, and we looked at contract law. And the classic example of a master agreement that we're going to look at is going to be the so-called ISDA master agreement, which is the standard market document for contracting for financial derivatives out there in the world. And one of the key things we're going to focus on within that is, when does it work and what are some of its problems? Okay. So this really is frontier, pioneer stuff, yeah? How do we document these things? What are some of the shortcomings? What are some of the advantages about the way it's done? Okay? And so, if you look at this lesson, a question about financial derivatives, that's really what it's talking about, you know, what are the shortcomings, what are the advantages, why do we do it this way? Okay? So that's going to be the bulk of our discussion tomorrow, is just reminding ourselves of vaguely how they're structured. And then, if you go over to page 119, 120, I've given you some of the key provisions from the ISDA Master Agreement there, and some case law that's been on them and how they work and don't work. And then over on page 121, some stuff about setting off when you're bankrupt, and also by the time we meet, hopefully tomorrow, I'll have copied some more of the standard market document for you, actually. Again, open book exam, you can take it with you. I think we're also going to talk about some of the ways in which people take security in these transactions, because there's a lot of shortcomings there. Okay? So I'll give you some of that stuff as you go along later on. So we're really looking at the few cases that have been on derivatives and things that have gone wrong. Yeah? What are the shortcomings? How would we make the documentation better? How are we doing that well in the world? Okay? Now, some of this, of course, will feed into you talking about the financial crisis. Generally, if that's an angle that interests you, what are the products, what are some of the things that have gone wrong with them? Okay? But it's an area in itself. How are they treated in law? What works and what doesn't? Alrighty, so I'm back on page 113 now. 113, look at all those pages we've gone through. How exciting. Oh, the things we've seen. financial derivatives. What is a derivative? A derivative, I define it, and other people do, I suppose. A derivative product is a financial product that derives its value from another underlying financial product. Okay. So the key types of derivative, on page 114, if that's bang opposite for you, as you can see through all the cat hairs, is the swap, the forward, and the option. Those are the three classic kinds of derivative. They derive their value, their worth, from, for example, an option to buy a share. That option is either valuable or not valuable if the share to which it relates rises or falls in value. Okay. So if you've got a right that you can buy a share from someone and they're compelled to sell it to you at 100 pence, and the market value of that share is 120 pence, then that option is really valuable to you. Because you can get that share for 100 and sell it straight away, but a profit of 20. Yeah? Brilliant. That option itself, therefore, derives its value entirely from the market value of the share. So that's what we mean. That's why they're called derivatives, because they derive their value from something else. If that share falls in value, so it's only worth 90 on the open market, you could buy it for 90, but your option says you have to pay 100 for it, well, that's useless. So its value could be 0, it could be 20, depending on the movements in the value of the share. Okay? So that's where we get the idea of a derivative from. What do we use derivatives for? And there are two, I think, very, very different purposes in the use of derivatives out there in the world. We're thinking about this commercially now, not just as lawyers. It can either be to earn income, yeah, profit, speculative profit, or it can be to manage risk. I'll explain that in more detail, particularly when we get to swaps in a second. You can use them to go to the 1, 2, 3, 4 list. You can use them simply to speculate. For example, that idea of an option to buy a share I just mentioned. You can use that to speculate on the value of shares. And this is what hedge funds do, particularly aggressively. As we'll talk about in a second, options are quite cheap to create. So they're great for a speculator. Because they let you look out into the future and say, I wonder where a share in ICI PLC is going to go in the future. Yeah? If you think it's going to increase in value from, you know, currently in the marketplace, let's say it's worth 90 today, and you think it might get up above 100. Well, what you might do is to go out to a bunch of investment banks and say, I want the right to buy, at a specified time in the future, a number of ICI shares from you at 100 pence each. And they'll think, that's a good bet, they're only at 90 now. And you're gambling, no, I'm speculating they're going to go up above 100. Yeah? And so as a hedge fund, you can be ready in case ICI shares do have a sudden spark in value, and then you've got the problem of how do I get them on the market quickly enough at a low enough price to sell at a profit. If you've already got options in place to say you're entitled to compel someone to sell them to you at 100, if the market punches through 100, you know you've got all those contracts in place. It only costs you a very small fee, known as a premium, we'll talk about in a second, to put an option in place. So they're comparatively cheap for you to create as a speculator. But the upside is brilliant. They enable you to move very, very quickly and take advantage of short-term glitches in the market. Remember long-term capital management we looked at in one of their documentaries last week? All the clever mathematicians that their hedge fund horribly failed. That's what they were doing. They were setting up all these options and forwards contracts in advance, so that they could very, very quickly, if there's just a glitch in a market where a price hasn't gone through properly and something's happened in the world and you know the price of something else will go up or down shortly afterwards, but it hasn't happened yet, that could be just a couple of minutes, there's that open window. If you've got an option in place, you can enforce your right immediately. And so that's what long-term capital management were trying to do. They had all these derivatives in place so they could swoop in wherever they needed to. Very, very complicated rafts of derivatives. So we can use them to speculate. Yeah? And this is where we talk about some of the dangers with financial derivatives. Because what's happening, of course, is these derivatives are being executed, the ones we're talking about, over the counter. That's the expression. Meaning, not on an exchange. So they're being done between private parties, on the telephone, nowhere near a stock exchange or any other kind of exchange. In other words, this is all invisible trading. You can do derivatives on exchange, we'll talk about that later on. The principal focus of derivatives markets is the off-exchange stuff, what's known as OTC, over-the-counter. Actually, the one fact about derivatives, my mum proudly tells everyone, I know something about derivatives, OTC. there are lots of jurisdictions that make it a criminal offence to speculate on certain types of securities, typically shares in government-owned entities, because there is all this hidden speculation that it's impossible to see from the outside, but nevertheless in the real world affects the real market price of those securities on the exchanges, because people hear the rumours about who's dealing with them off exchange. So derivatives can have that really destabilising effect that bankers, people in the club, know what's going on, but it's impossible to see it from the outside. And this in the early days is why people were really concerned about derivatives. All these what are now referred to in the jargon as dark pools, because no one can see it, the regulators don't know what's there. These dark pools of investment capital are hidden, and people are speculating on these things quietly in the background. So there's that speculative activity, and derivatives make billions in dollars for all these investment banks, because they're an incredibly clever way of playing the markets. If you've got the clever mathematicians, the clever quants, they're able to build strategies that will anticipate what the market will do in the future. You get your strategy laid out. It's like setting a whole bunch of traps, yeah? You work out where people are going to go, you set your traps in. That's a nice metaphor, isn't it? The other way of using derivatives is far more benign, and that's risk management, so-called. Yeah? Managing risk. If you have an exposure to a marketplace, suppose you have an exposure to interest rates rising in the UK. You might say, well, if we look at ICI PLC share movements, if interest rates go up, they tend to earn more profits. And therefore you might think one way of trying to cover our risk on our interest rate costs going up might be to say, well, let's buy a bunch of options. Because if interest rates go up, then if we buy them in a bank that charges interest rate or something like ICI, if their profits tend to go up at the same time, then we'll be able to cover our increased interest rate cost by having a whole bunch of options in place, because their shares will increase in value too. So there are clever mathematical ways of looking at how markets tend to interact, there's a fun new word, whereby you can develop a strategy using derivatives that can cover some of your financial risks. You can cover some of your exposures by buying the right kinds of products. So one of the ways of using derivatives is to say, let's buy a product which will generate us a profit at a time when otherwise we might suffer a loss. And this is one of the discussions I have in chapter 1 of the textbook under the heading of financialization. Fun word, not my own. One of the other concerns people have about derivatives is that all sounds brilliant if you believe in the maths. All of this works if we believe that ICI PLC shares will respond in exactly that way to an interest rate movement. It assumes that nothing else is going on in the world that actually will mean their shares don't move in value or even fall in value. It assumes that all the mathematical predictions are correct. And this is long-term capital management's problem. Their mathematical assumptions were based on 5 years historical data, not anymore. And so when something happened that hadn't happened in the previous 5 years, Russian banking moratorium, suddenly all their maths, all their sums were thrown out the window, and it all went horribly out of whack. So that's one of the dangers with using derivatives to hedge your risks, as it's called, is because you assume that your mathematical bets are going to pay off in the way you anticipate. So that's known as hedging. Yeah? You try and protect an exposure you've got. The jargon term is you hedge it. Not entirely sure where that came from. Rather clumsily, I've covered 3 and 4, but I'm just beginning to explain. Asset liability management is a way of sort of building on speculation, building on managing risk. Instead of just thinking of it as one transaction at a time, if you look across an entire portfolio of investments, then we'll be talking in Property Law 2 about trust investment and the need to diversify and the bigger the fund, the more the diversification. Well, what we might do with derivatives is to build a whole panoply of strategies whereby we're able to speculate on share markets, bond markets, interest rate markets, commodities markets, whether the weather changes, I'll talk about later on, so-called energy derivatives. We can build a portfolio of investments across all of these areas that will balance out our existing assets and liabilities. So it isn't just one transaction by one transaction. We can be creating There are thousands of these things at once. As many as our brains and our computers can cope with. And arbitrage was something I mentioned before. Arbitrage refers to that long-term capital management type issue of, can you try and anticipate, like laying traps in advance, where things might go wrong in the market, or where things might be advantageous in the market, so that you can swoop on a short-term change. You can take advantage of something in the short term. So by putting lots of derivatives in place, you give yourself the tool to move instantaneously, to arbitrage, to take advantage of a short-term difference between one market and another. Because obviously information has to move, people have to actually buy and sell those shares before the share price moves. If you can get in there in those 1 or 2 minutes, and you've got your derivatives in place already, you can take advantage of that very quickly. The other thing you can do is also you can program your computers. You don't even need a human brain to do that. You can program a computer to say, as soon as that price hits 65, the computer will start selling. Or as soon as it is 65, they'll start buying. So you can automate your systems to do that stuff for you. This panicked people a good few years ago in the last kind of mini run. Long-term capital management and all those kind of things. So people have programmed their computers to say, if it hits 65, sell. If it hits 55, sell even harder. You know, if it hits 40, then start buying in. And the trouble was, no one could stop this stuff in time because the market just suddenly got its own momentum where everyone's computers would say, sell every time it drops another 10. And so the computers were selling stuff automatically and it was trying to stop, pull the plug out. Because you'd already set up the strategies and you hadn't thought you were going to go 10, then 10, then 10, then 10. They just thought it'll fall 10 and then we'll sell and then it will stop there, presumably. This idea that it was just going to keep going and going and going. So there's no human brain there. In advance, as a mathematician, but again the assumption is we won't fall 10, then another 10, then another 10. That's not going to happen, it'd be stupid. We'll fall 10 and it will stop. And actually the world sometimes doesn't work like that. So there's a big problem there, a kind of practical one for us as lawyers, actually. You know, I think we become the adults in the room often. You know, whenever you talk to an economist, whenever you talk to a mathematician, I do this occasionally, there'll be someone from the economics department who's into game theory, yeah? Come over and say, we do the economics on how people guess in the marketplace, the bets they take, the risks they take, and what, you know, an economy needs to do to meet with that. And there was some economists here that have moved on now, who wanted to look at the bets people took in divorce proceedings. What in a kind of game theory way might people be doing when they're going to divorce? What kind of bets would you take? What might you do in response to how divorce law might treat you? And what they wanted to say, what they wanted me to kind of sign off on, is it possible for you to have a divorce where you don't need to go to court, where everything's divided 50-50 and there's no rancour, you know, no one has an argument and no lawyers get involved? And you think, well, theoretically I suppose, but it's not going to happen. As soon as there's a lawyer involved, it all goes horrible. And that's what we're here for. That's where we make our money. And they wanted me to say, the world is going to be completely benign, nothing will ever change, nothing in the outside world will come in the way, no judge will interfere, no lawyer will interfere, they'll just be able to make pure decisions gambling against each other. And I said, well, it's possible, but no. And that was all they wanted to know. They built an entire model of how people react in divorce proceedings on an entirely unreal assumption that no lawyers would get involved and nothing would go wrong. Mathematicians are much the same. There are a set of assumptions, and they don't think outside those assumptions. Part of what our role is as lawyers, putting these deals together, is to think, what else could happen? What else could go wrong? We become the adults in the room. I'm sure I've told you this story at Goldman. The guy with the 14 computers on his desk had a PhD in rocket science, very clever man. And I remember looking at this model, and two things would bother me. One, why do we never put all these mathematical models in the contracts? If I want to argue frustration of a contract in 6 months' time, I want to be able to say, that's what we expected in the formulae we were all using, and therefore if something's happened that's not in that formula, the whole basis of the transaction is not what we expected, it's a commercially different deal, therefore we can write it off. And I was really pushing this idea on people saying, you know, volatile markets, we want to be able to get out of things on the downside, so let's start putting these in the contract. And this guy for some reason seemed to think this thing couldn't be attached to a contract because it was far too beautiful to be stapled to anything. And I said, okay, well, let's have a look. So we got this thing up, and this was the other, I'd had another victory with someone else on the same floor when I pointed at a Black-Scholes model and said, I thought that was 2x, is it not 2x? And they said, oh, and I just left immediately because they spotted there was actually a problem and I looked like a genius. The other thing I said to this particular bloke with their 14 screens is, where's the next Gulf War on this? Yeah. We've got a whole bunch of things in here, including speculating on the future price of oil and all kinds of things, and oil would affect a lot of the shares that were in the thing that we were putting together. And he said there won't be another Gulf War. This was 1995. And how do you know? This contract is going to last for 10 years. And of course, as is well known, in 2003, you know, the US military did go into Iraq. I don't know if you've heard about it. I'm sure it's been in the papers. You know, and just hadn't anticipated that. Just there was no political risk idea in this at all. It was going to be a benign market. Nothing was going to happen. We were all going to react entirely to this maths and it would solve the world in the future. And just didn't. And as you as lawyers will have ideas of things that you think will go right and wrong and things that you will or won't anticipate. And that's why you actually need all those people to work together and talk about what is it they will see. They're seeing the they come to get us again. Stop, arrest them or go home. Yes, thank you. So I think there is, you know, something in there about all of this, about the commercial underpinnings of all this kind of stuff, of driving these deals. And what we need to think about is, given all of that creative chaos in these markets, how do we document these things, and are we doing it properly? Are we actually going to protect the ladies and gentlemen whom we advise from the terrible things they're doing to each other in the world? Okay. What we're going to do first, though, is talk about how the products actually function. Now, our plan is, because we've rescheduled that we're supposed to be here till 7, that being the case, I suggest we take 5 or 10 minutes or something now for you all to go another comfort break. So if you come back up 6:05, I make it, and we'll get on with all that. Okay. And apologies we couldn't manage to rearrange the room. I didn't notice the George Hine, there were other things going on.